After 16 years, the FBI finally has its man. Boston mob boss James Whitey Bulger was captured in Southern California along with his longtime girlfriend. The 81-year-old faces charges from extortion to murder when he goes to court in just a few hours. Bulger was the inspiration for the Jack Nicholson character in the 2006 Oscar-winning film The Departed. He has been on the FBI's 10 most wanted list for his alleged role in some 19 murders.
My first question was, you present Whitey Bulger's story in the context of his family history, and you trace it all the way back to Ireland. Did you feel like that was important to tell his overall story?
We did. Having written Black Mass, previous book that focused on what we now call the Black Mass years, which were the years in which Whitey Bulger served as an FBI informant in Boston, and also corrupted the Boston office of the FBI so that they basically were working for him. It turned out to be the biggest informant scandal in FBI history. So as journalists, writing first for the Boston Globe and then in this book called Black Mass, we focused on those nearly two decades of this, what was called this unholy alliance. So what we're doing in the biography, because with his capture, I think history is going to show that Whitey Bulger is one of the more significant crime figures of the 20th century. It just felt warranted by virtue of his longevity, and most importantly, by virtue of his corrupting of the FBI. He warranted a full biography, mm-hmm. and putting those Black Mass years in the context of an entire life, because he's been around a long time, and you start looking at him and you end up going to all kinds of neat places throughout the 20th century. Mm-hmm. That's why we went that way. And the other sort of pivotal thing was that in 1975, when he did start informing for the FBI, he was in his late 40s. So he'd already lived half a life. And for someone who, around here and then increasingly beyond Boston, who's had this kind of name recognition, very little was known about that half a life that he'd already lived. It's all been since, the FBI stuff and the murders and the mayhem and the crime boss years. But what about the making of this monster, and that was largely uncharted territory. In our own book, we maybe, went over it in about 10 pages, and other books by other journalists, and even the gangster tell-alls, there's been a whole 8 or 9 books in the past decade about this whole saga. None of them really had gotten into who this guy really was, and so I think that's what our challenge was going into the biography.
So you talk about where did this guy come from. Can you talk a little bit about the family he came from and the world that he came from? What was South Boston like in the 40s and 50s that he grew up in?
Well, it was largely Irish American immigrants, blue collar, real working class. And they were actually, and this is one of the things that means a lot around here, Whitey wasn't born in South Boston. His family had moved around and bounced around. And then in 1938, when he was already 9 years old, the family moved into the first housing project, not only in Boston, but a public housing project in America. And they got a real good jump start, a fresh start in these, spanking brand new, public housing projects that for a lot of people were it was like hitting the lottery because it had hot water and heat, and we're talking about a time when a lot of struggling families were dealing with cold water flats. So they got lucky to get into the opening of what was then called the Old Harbor Housing Project, and Whitey was 9. And one of the questions that we had to confront is that South Boston, back then and even now, even though it's been gentrified, was a very insular, inward-looking neighborhood, suspicious of outsiders. And if you weren't of Southie, you didn't belong. And so we've always wondered, why weren't the Bulgers, who were new, were outliers, so to speak? Why didn't Whitey and his brothers and sisters ever have to deal with what so many other people did when they tried to move into the neighborhood? Mm-hmm. I think a big part of the answer was because they were part of this basically this, you know, new neighborhood in the housing project where everybody was new, you know. So that, I think, blunted a lot of the kinds of, if you were just a single family moving into an empty house on a block, it was tough sometimes to, you know, to get integrated into that neighborhood. Mm-hmm. But when you have, you know, hundreds and hundreds of families, some many of whom coming from Southie, but others coming from all over the city, like the Bulgers, you're all in the same boat. So I don't think they had to overcome anything, and they were adopted and became very much part of Southie and the fabric of Southie, and most people assume that they were go back generations in Southie when in fact they don't. You know?
Mm-hmm. And his life of crime starts pretty early. Can you talk a little bit about, you know, the evolution of his criminal activity and then how he finally stops getting lucky and ends up going away for a long stretch?
Yeah, yeah. We're talking about, again, into the 1930s and into the 40s, what would be called a juvenile delinquent. He was, you know, he was pretty bad from the start in terms of being tough in school and preferring, you know, running the streets. He was a young runaway. He got in trouble a fair amount. And I think there were two themes that get established at an early age. One being that he rarely, for a long time, faced any consequences. You know, we were able to get a hold of his juvenile record, and then when he turned 18, his, you know, his early criminal record. Time and time again, he'd be picked up for, you know, stealing off the back of a truck, an assault charge, even an attempted rape charge. But time and time again, somehow he got the case dropped or charges dropped. One time, he, as a juvenile, he was sentenced to go away to the boys' detention prison, you know, residential thing, and then he appealed it, and he got it overturned, and instead he went home. This kind of, I think, fed what became this lifelong sense of entitlement, mm-hmm. you know, that he's had toward everything, that he can do whatever he wants, and it's on stage now in a huge way because he was enabled by the FBI to think he could, you know, commit murder and get away with it. But that gets established early on, I think. And the other thing that's going on, I think, in the dynamic is that we were able to, I think, dig deep on is that, and I wish we knew even more, but his father was in the context of that time, he was, when Whitey was 11, 12, turning into a teenager, his father was already almost 60 years old. And life expectancy for men at that time frame was like 61. So he was an extreme, you know, for the context, an old guy. Mm-hmm. He was quiet and he was remote. He had lost an arm in a boyhood accident. So while the rest of America, the men of America, were going off and fighting in World War II, this was a guy who was sidelined. He and Whitey did not get along. There's, again, evidence all through Whitey's life that he hated his father. So he was out on the street, and it was on the street that he got enabled, reinforced, and what we called even nourished. He was somebody, you know, that classic, I'm somebody. And I think all that kind of stuff kept, you know, getting, you know, reinforced and snowballed, and he just started going up the ladder of crime, from the stuff that a juvenile delinquent does in terms of stealing cars and stealing off the back of trucks to, by the time he hit the early 1950s, he was carrying a gun and robbing banks, which was the crime du jour in the early 50s. I mean, if you were anybody, you were robbing banks. Mm. It's fascinating to research that time, too, because in those days, what we take for granted when you go into a bank, like, you know, the screens and the bars on the counter and everything, they didn't exist until this early 50s when there was a plague of bank robberies, and law enforcement with the banking industry realizes we've got to put up cages and stuff mm-hmm. like that so they can't be just flying over and standing up in the counter and waving guns and stuff like that. So he got into that a bit, but after he got in 1955 and 1956, he got charged in three bank robberies, one here in Massachusetts, one in Rhode Island, and one in Indiana. And so he was caught, and he was ratted out by some of his cohorts in the robberies, and ended up getting sentenced to 20 years in prison.
Mm-hmm. And when he comes out, he does about 9 years, and when he comes out, he's back on the streets, and he's kind of laying smack dab in the middle of this, or the tail end of this Boston gang war, and it kind of gets positioned to put himself in a position of authority at the end of it. Can you talk about that a little bit, how that played out?
Yeah, a lot of it gets into, you know, really kind of detailed Boston Irish gang politics and names, but I think you have a handle on that, you know, in an overview. And yeah, he came back at the end of an infamous Irish gang war where there were 60 bodies between competing Irish gangs. And he aligned himself, you know, got settled into, you know, one faction. And in the course of a few years, and he really started to exhibit his sort of strategy and genius. He double-crossed a bunch of people, but he repositioned himself so that over the course of a few years, he managed to come up on top of the single gang. It was kind of a merger of the competing factions, you know, reaching some kind of, you know, peace, so to speak. And on top of that was none other than Whitey Bulger, and it became a branch of an even larger gang that was based out of Somerville called the Winter Hill Gang. So a lot of politics in there in terms of, you know, the underworld. A lot of machinations, a lot of bodies, a lot of strong personalities, and he found a way to not only survive but come out on top and becoming boss of the South Boston branch or the South Boston Irish gang put him in a position to really take off as the 70s wore on, and then he struck this deal with the FBI in Boston.
And that just the Boston gang war thing could probably be a book on its own someday.
Oh, God, plenty's been written, and it's certainly taken up parts of other books, and yeah, I'm sure I've always heard talk of movies, and that's something that happened in the 60s, and Whitey, that might have been, you know, clearly a silver lining of doing his hard time for bank robbery, because, you know, who knows what, it was chaos, and he could have, you know, got, you know, either, you know, survived, obviously, or had gone down in the crossfire that was pretty commonplace for a few years.
So once he's kind of firmly on top by the mid-70s, how does South Boston change in the 70s and 80s, not only, like, his criminal world, but just the entire area there?
Well, culturally and demographically, it's still a hardcore, you know, Irish, American, Southie pride, you know, all for one and one for all kind of environment. It doesn't start to, you know, gentrify until, you know, the late 80s and into the 90s. So it's still a pretty intense place. And busing was, you know, Southie was portrayed as a hotbed of racism unfairly in many ways, during busing. But it was an intensely cohesive and, you know, proud place, you know, the slogan Southie Pride. And in that context in the 70s and 80s, you know, Whitey came into his own as a crime boss and emerged as the most powerful gangster in the city. And we haven't mentioned his brother Bill, his younger brother Bill, emerged. He chose politics. He went to Boston College Law School and became a lawyer and went into politics. He emerged as one of the most powerful politicians in the state as president of the state Senate. So the 80s was really, you know, the time of the Bulger brothers, each at the top of their game, one in the underworld and one in the state house.
And another South Boston player comes in here, and that's another guy who grew up in their housing project, John Connolly.
Right. Yeah. The John Connolly is the FBI agent who was able to, you know, bridge the FBI with Whitey Bulger in this informant relationship. It's almost like this, you know, that using the what's become a cliche, the perfect storm of events. You had Whitey on the make and on the rise, incredibly ambitious, in, you know, in the mid 70s, and here you had this younger agent, John Connolly, from the same housing project originally as Whitey, but 10 years younger, and a younger man, devoted and admiring of the Bulger family, both Bill and Whitey. And he, inside the FBI, is extremely outgoing and extremely ambitious. And he understands that the way the FBI was working then in its war on the mafia, that in recruiting informants, that this was a career moment when if he could land, Whitey Bulger, one of the top Irish gangsters, to help them in their crusade against the mafia. So on paper, in some ways, it made sense. But if you get past the names and get into the personalities and the dynamics, it made awful sense because, you know, once the deal was sealed in 75, Whitey, there's no question now, with all the records we've had and examined and analyzed, that right from the get-go, it was Whitey who was in charge of Connolly, not Connolly, the handler, the FBI agent in charge of the underworld informant. And what went on for the next 20 years is the stuff of Black Mass, is the stuff of biographies, the stuff of movies, and it's an enormous, almost endless toxic spill of damage, corruption, murder, and mayhem. It's eye-popping.
So he pretty much had free, I'm talking about Whitey now, he pretty much had free reign to do whatever he wanted until he's forced to go on the run in the mid-90s.
Yeah, and it's been called. Yeah, he literally had a license to kill. He killed, we counted up 11 killings that are known that he committed while on what we call FBI time. A handful of those being the result of leaks, tips from John Connolly that so-and-so's ratting you out. Mm-hmm. And so the solution was to kill. It's horrific stuff. So he did on the street, have a license to kill. And in fact, in his current legal troubles, he's been trying to argue that that the FBI, the government, had given him immunity, meaning permission, and in effect to do this license to kill as part of their deal, which is, got every lawyer in town, or most lawyers except his defense lawyer, rolling their eyes saying no one gets a license to kill. It is quite remarkable. And it went on until the mid-90s when this goes for so long that you're talking about turning the page of history and a whole new generation of prosecutors come in, and starting in the late 80s, they start making a case against the biggest gangster in town, finally. And that finally ripens with an indictment in 95 that leads to, Whitey taking off and becoming a fugitive from justice.
Mm-hmm. And shortly after he takes off, the word gets around that he had been an informant for years and years and years. How did that reaction play out in Boston?
That was volcanic because... And it's hard now because we know, the truth about Whitey. But before the public did, Whitey had this kind of almost, Robin Hood persona, popular culture as being the Boston's good, bad guy, the ultimate stand-up Irish gangster who, for whom loyalty was everything. And betrayal was the worst possible sin, being a snitch or a rat. I mean, it goes deep into the Irish culture. The idea of being an informant as being, one of the most unacceptable things in human life. So the idea, so the truth, the reality that he himself was a top echelon informant for the FBI, it took a lot of people. It took us as journalists who first, exposed it and writing about it in the Boston Globe. It takes a while to get your head around it, given, who he was and his reputation back in the 80s when the truth started to tumble out. And so it took a while for it to take hold in the public consciousness as well. It just seemed so unfathomable. Mm-hmm. He was known as the kind of guy that if he suspected anyone of being a snitch, that was the end, because it was so such an essential basic sin against everything they stood for. Mm-hmm. His gang, when they found out, and they had no, many of them had no idea, they were all at first in disbelief, and they thought it was some kind of government conspiracy, that it can't be true.
Yeah. Would that be like Kevin Weeks? I know he's written a couple books about this.
Yeah.
Okay.
Kevin Weeks, who was basically Whitey's driver and a much younger man who was, you know, kind of he was always with him, a confidant. Some called him his surrogate son. I mean, they were starting around, I think they hooked up in around 1980. For most of the decade of the 80s, when all, you know, again, those were the key years of what we're talking about in the Black Mass years. Kevin was, you know, the right-hand man. And he was just knocked for a loop when the truth came out about Whitey being an informant. You know, Whitey was always seen with this Agent Connolly, and Weeks dealt with Agent Connolly as well. I mean, Connolly was part of their world. But the way it was always pitched inside the gang by Whitey Bulger was that Connolly's our corrupt agent. They paid Connolly money. He was their source inside the FBI. And so that's why, you know, that's how, why it could all be sort of accepted on that one half of the coin. They had no idea that the deal was that Whitey was, you know, feeding Connolly, you know, intelligence along the way as well. Mm-hmm. So Kevin Weeks, it blew his mind. It blew John Matarano's mind, who was basically the gang's hitman, who, you know, who rivaled Whitey in terms of the ease with which he killed people and his body count. Yeah, just everybody else except the one person we haven't mentioned is his partner, Steve Fleming. Mm-hmm. And because Steve Fleming was also a longtime FBI informant, so the two of them were in it together that way.
So what, he was on the run for about 15 years, and, you know,
yep.
Big news when they finally found him out in Santa Monica. Did you, I mean, in the journalist world up there, did you guys have theories about where you thought he might be? Did you personally have one?
Yeah, but it would change. I mean, we're talking about a lot of years, and when you kind of went in and out of focus on it, because it's not something you talked about all the time, but it was certainly water cooler conversation here in Boston on, you know, radio talk, you know, every once in a while when there might be a possible sighting, or where could he be? It just started up all over again. You know, the sort of sense was that, you know, by the water, warm weather, I mean, the kind of things that turned out to be true, because those are the kinds of things he was known to like. But I don't think, certainly not California. I mean, I never thought of California, and I don't, it was more like, you know, some faraway South American kind of place, or Europe. And, I mean, Kevin Weeks himself, who had been in touch with him for a couple of years, at the beginning of Whitey's fugitive period. At the end, you know, after 9/11, he always, and I think he speculates this in his book, that after 9/11, he always believed that Whitey got stuck, you know, overseas somewhere and had never gotten back because it was so hard to travel anymore. Mm-hmm. Boy, you know, he was wrong, you know.
Yeah.
And there was a guy who, you know, you couldn't get any closer to Whitey Bulger in terms of, you know, knowing him and knowing what he thinks.
So how do you think this whole trial and everything is going to play out?
Well, the one thing I think I can say with some confidence is that Whitey's toast. I mean, he's never going to see the light of day, beyond shackles in a prison cell. Mm-hmm. So, but beyond that, it's a good question. I sure hope he testifies. He says he will, and if he does, that's going to be one of those proverbial trial of the century kind of moments.
Mm-hmm.
I may even get up close to being kind of an O.J. Simpson moment in terms of the national interest in his testimony. Who knows what there? You know, there might be some bombshell surprises about the FBI. Because, again, we're covering a lot of years and a lot of ground, and even though we've learned a lot, there's still probably plenty to learn, and he might, you know, be in a position, or his lawyers, of either dropping some bombshells or extracting some others from the government. So, emphasize, I mean, the importance of a lot of this in terms of, you know, of our country or of our society is hopefully the lessons learned from the FBI wrongdoing here and the deeply flawed informant program that they launched. That's, I think, you know, besides the kind of the drama and the sensation of the gangster life and the life of crime, to me, it's, in some ways, the really important thing is that, you know, is how did it go so bad for so long at the FBI, and you know, how do you stop this from ever happening again, in terms of intelligence and law enforcement? Because, I mean, they took a huge hit in this, and through the corruption, the city and beyond took a huge hit. A lot of people died who probably didn't have to die because of this corruption at the FBI.
Mm-hmm. And then the last thing I wanted to ask you was, this story is really big right now, all over the place, and there's not one, not two, but three movies in the works right now.
Yep.
Are you going to play a role in any of that, or how do you feel about that whole thing?
Well, I think if you check it out, it's Black Mass, the book that Jerry and I O'Neill wrote prior to you know, our new book, Whitey.
Mm-hmm.
That is one of those projects, and it's been, you know, plenty in the news in the last month or so. I've got about the producers having the financing. They're ready to roll. They're expected to be here by the end of June, I think it is, filming with Barry Levinson's directing it, who's a big name, and Johnny Depp has signed on to play Whitey Bulger. And it's not just, I mean, I've been through this a lot in terms of the strange, bizarre, surreal Hollywood side of things because of all the different interest in Black Mass over the years. But I can tell you just from the contact I'm having with all these people and especially, you know, the director and the creative people about as they're working and getting the story and the polish, that, I mean, this feels different and very real from anything that's been talked about before. And I don't think those other projects are even close. You know, there's always lots of Hollywood talk about lots of things. So, all I can say is that this one sounds real this time. Yeah.
Good. Well, thanks a lot for taking the time to talk. And
sure.
I love the book.
Yeah, no, I appreciate it. Okay, great.
All right. Thanks again.
Yeah. Thank you. Good night, man.
Bye.